Elizabethtown College history professor David S. Brown is the author of a new book about former President Andrew Jackson. Brown writes that he is the first president to be born in a log cabin, to live beyond the Appalachians, and to rule, so he swore, in the name of the people. The title of the book is The First Populace, The Defiant Life of Andrew Jackson. He was president for 2 terms, 8 years, from 1829 to 1837. Jackson, in his lifetime, was a jurist, a general, a congressman, a senator, and America's 7th president. Professor David Brown, what is a populist?
A populist is someone who is going to put the idea of democracy and popular appeal, popular democracy, over perhaps a more reflective or deliberative approach to, it could be governance, it could be art, it could be lots of things. Populism is something that I think is probably pretty deep in the American DNA.
Why does the front of the book say that Andrew Jackson led a defiant life?
Right. So Jackson, I think, might agree with that in certain respects. I think that this is somebody who liked opposition, needed opposition. I think was most effective when he could identify an enemy. And so throughout his life, before his presidency, during and after his presidency, he seemed to thrive off of contention, off of adversity. It seemed to focus him. He was someone who could conjure up a great deal of animosity towards others, and in return, had that animosity come back to him. But as I mentioned, it seemed to focus him.
You know, you've written a number of books, including one on Henry Adams, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Richard Hofstadter. Why Andrew Jackson? What led you to this, compared to the others?
Well, you know, I was writing a book you mentioned on Henry Adams, and I was really thinking about the 19th century and what a vital century it was to America. And, you know, I decided to call that book The Last American Aristocrat. And it seemed to me that, you know, populism, popular democracy in the 19th century, it was such a vital feature of American life. You know, maybe in 19th century France, it was the emergence of the bourgeoisie. In America, the 19th century, I think it was this westward drift. I think it was this emerging popular democracy. And so in looking at Henry Adams as you know, kind of coming out of that ducal Adams quasi-aristocratic family, that was really the early 19th century. But that was changing by Adams's time, very much so. And finishing that project, I was interested in looking at Andrew Jackson, someone who I think embodied, didn't create it, but he sort of embodied the emergence of that system of popular politics, which so, I think, profoundly displaced the Adams family.
You know, if you come to Washington, there's the Hay Adams Hotel, and about 100 steps closer to the White House is the Andrew Jackson statue.
Yes.
Why do you think? Go ahead.
No, it's a great observation. Our statue culture is interesting. We know Andrew Jackson in many respects. One is for the bank war. And in Nashville, there's a branch of the Federal Reserve, and it's not very far from a Jackson statue. And, of course, Jackson was a great enemy of that type of financial centralization.
In your acknowledgments in the back of the book, you say that your interest in Jackson started in graduate school. Mm-hmm. Why?
So I was looking for a project. I was at an Ohio institution, the University of Toledo, and I wanted to do something local. And so I fell upon the Whig Party in Ohio. And the Whigs came about in the early 1830s as an opposition party to Andrew Jackson, to the Jacksonians. And that was my real introduction to the Jacksonians and to Jacksonian politics. So it came out of graduate school, but it's something that's always kind of there. If you study American politics, then issues, questions of populism are always going to be there, and you just can't get away from looking at the 19th century, and you can't get away from somebody like Andrew Jackson.
What does it mean to you that a portrait of Andrew Jackson has been in the Oval Office for the following four presidents: Lyndon Johnson, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump?
It tells me that despite Jackson's, the controversial nature of his presidency, that he has been, up until recent times, last couple of decades, a fairly ecumenical political figure, meaning, of course, that the Republicans and Democrats had, in some sense, both, agreed that Jackson was a national hero. In other words, kind of where Jefferson went, and kind of where Washington and Lincoln went as well. Not so much Democrats or Republicans, but these figures had become national figures. Jackson had become that.
When he was 21, you say in your book that somebody named Waitstill Avery and Jackson got into it over what?
Jackson thought that he had been kind of attacked in court, showed up by an older, more savvy lawyer. And in fact, he had. And so Jackson wanted to assert the fact that he was a gentleman. And one of the ways to do this was to challenge someone to a duel, if in fact you thought that there was grounds. So Jackson turns this, a kind of retort in court, a minor embarrassment, into an opportunity to challenge this gentleman and to face him down. They actually don't fire shots at each other. That was something that the handlers had taken care of beforehand. But I think for the first time, it asserted that Jackson was a gentleman. He had attempted to do this in other ways, purchasing land. He had begun to purchase enslaved people. He was looking to involve himself in the military, the militia in Tennessee. And a duel was all part of that kind of growing up process for Jackson, to be taken seriously as a gentleman.
Avery was 47. Jackson was 21.
Yes. One could argue that there was not a lot of honor in Jackson pushing for this duel. Avery was also an accomplished figure, and perhaps for that reason, all the more, made Jackson all the more eager to challenge him. Jackson may have also had a sense that he could get by with this without there actually being bloodshed, without actually, firing at Avery or having Avery fire at him. One can speculate if it didn't turn out that way, if in fact they did actually go through with the duel and fired each other, not just up into the air. And if Jackson had killed Avery, then perhaps that might have nipped Jackson's budding career right there.
How does it turn out that you agree not to point the gun at each other?
Handlers, you've got seconds, and these gentlemen are working behind the scenes. It was pretty evident that in this case, the offense really wasn't that considerable, and neither man was really looking to risk their lives. And so it probably would not have been very difficult in this case for the seconds to have reached an agreement that both gentlemen had recognized the integrity of the other, and therefore to go through with the protocol to meet, but when it was time to fire, both had agreed to fire up into the sky.
Before we go on, Elizabethtown College is where?
It is in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
How long have you been there?
I've just finished my 25th year at this college.
What do you teach?
I teach courses in American history.
And as someone who went to Wright State University for your bachelor's in Ohio in 90, University of Akron in 92 for your master's, and the University of Toledo in 95 for your PhD, why did you move to Pennsylvania?
I moved to Pennsylvania because it was a job. It was a tenure track position. It was offered to me, and I think I was very fortunate to get it.
What was the first thing you wrote in your dissertation? What was that about?
The dissertation was on the Whig Party in Ohio.
Did you write a book on Thomas Jefferson?
I wrote a, I was still in graduate school and signed a contract to write a reference book, an encyclopedia on Thomas Jefferson.
It's, I think you said in your book that Andrew Jackson knew Thomas Jefferson or was alive with Thomas Jefferson. How well did they know each other and what did they think of one another?
They didn't know each other terribly well, but they did know each other. Neither was particularly impressed with the other. When Jefferson was the vice president, that, of course, made him president of the U.S. Senate. Jackson was briefly in the Senate as a young man. Jefferson thought that he was erratic, that he was voluble, emotional, and prone to anger easily. Jackson thought that he was being held back because of Jackson's friendship with Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr had been Thomas Jefferson's vice president for one term. There was a bit of a falling out. Burr is probably mostly known for the Burr affair, the possible attempt to try to sever a small empire in the Southwest for himself and maybe a rogue army. And on several occasions, Burr had passed through Nashville and had contracted with Jackson for supports, for supplies. Jackson thinking that the U.S. government, that the Jefferson administration wants to see this happen. So he was a bit fooled there. So because of his closeness with Aaron Burr, first Jefferson and then Jefferson's successor, James Madison, in the presidency, they seemed to be very reticent to embrace Andrew Jackson. And it would really only be with the War of 1812 and a slew of retirements that Jackson was brought out of the Tennessee militia and into the regular army.
What was the War of 1812 about?
War of 1812, its focus is really in Europe, the playing out of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic conflicts that ensue. In the United States, the United States really looking to do a few things. I think in part to move against Native Americans in the West, to assert or reassert independence against British rule of the seas, British confiscation, kidnappings of American citizens, sailors on the high seas, and an effort, I think, on the part of the country to begin to develop an industrial base and also begin to move towards internal improvements, canals, macadamized roads. And the war helped to sort of generate a really tremendous amount of energy in which all of these things begin to happen.
Jackson was president from 1829 to 1837, but when he was 36 years old in 1803, there was a duel with somebody named Sevier. Who was Sevier, and what was the story behind the duel?
Yeah, Sevier was a frontier hero in Tennessee. He was an older man, and I think at the nub of it, I think of it not too differently than I do, say, the very famous duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. I think New York was too small of a state to hold the aspirations of both of those men. Tennessee was even smaller. Jackson and Sevier, they kept knocking heads against each other. Sevier, the older lion; Jackson, the rising cub. But whether it was for civic appointments or marshal appointments. You know, who had had the militia in Tennessee? They kept finding themselves kind of pressed up against each other. Jackson was not one, at least at that point in his life, to defer necessarily to more accomplished people, or to his seniors. They did get into a fracas. It was supposed to be a duel, but really it was just a kind of a melee. Like I said, I think the origins go really into the question of Tennessee politics and opportunities. But on the surface, Sevier had made some unseemly comments about Andrew Jackson. And Jackson's marriage, Jackson's wife. Jackson's wife was actually married when she then married Andrew Jackson. She thought that her husband had gotten a divorce, but he had not. And in fact, they had been living basically as a common law couple. And Sevier brought that up in a public fashion, and Jackson challenged him. Sevier seemed to be playing, you know, kind of cat and mouse with Jackson, very eager, so he said in correspondence, to engage the younger man, but kept putting it off and putting it off. Finally, they did meet, and as I mentioned, it was a bit of a fracas. It was chaos. They draw arms on each other before the duel can even be set up. The seconds, the handlers, everyone's pulling out guns and weapons. To make a long story short, nobody was killed. And in fact, both parties ended up coming back to Nashville together.
Well, you quote Andrew Jackson saying, "To all who shall see these presents, greeting. Know ye that I, Andrew Jackson, do pronounce, publish, and declare the world that His Excellency John Sevier, Esquire, Captain General and Commander-in-Chief of the Land and Naval Forces within the State of Tennessee, is a base coward and a poltroon."
Yes.
How strong is that in those days?
That's very strong. Poltroon is I think, really the trip word there. And if you call somebody that, you're asking for a duel. Or you're asking for the other person to surrender to you, basically. So it's a code word, and if that's used, then you know that the person really means business. So there's a degree of language. There's escalation, and basically Jackson goes for the jugular. When he uses those words, he wants to engage in a duel, and probably at that time did want to engage in a duel, didn't want the handlers to clean it up.
When he was 36 years old and involved in all this with Sevier, and there is a town now in Tennessee called Sevierville, what were the two men doing?
I'm sorry, could you ask that again?
At the time of the duel, what was John Sevier doing and what was Andrew Jackson doing?
So both of them actually, you know, kind of shared a position. As I mentioned, there was a competition throughout their public careers, and they both had a piece of the Tennessee militia. At one time, there was only one commander of the militia, but it was determined that Sevier in East Tennessee, he should essentially be given his province. But Nashville in West Tennessee, and Jackson as being the embodiment of that, Jackson, he should be able to have part of that commission as well. And so it was split up, and so they both had a large piece of regional piece of the Tennessee militia. Jackson, you know, also was a justice of the peace. And Sevier was eager to remind him of that the duels that the laws in Tennessee they prohibited dueling, and that wasn't it ironic that Jackson, who sat on the Supreme Court of the state, was so willing to elide the law, to break the law, and engage in a flagrantly illegal activity.
What was Andrew Jackson's image in the state of Tennessee around that same time, or did he have one in the whole state?
I would say that his image was not as high profile as Sevier's. Sevier was a frontier legend. People knew Sevier from the American Revolution. Jackson had fought in the American Revolution as well. He was a teenager. He was actually a POW, but didn't have the reputation of Sevier. Jackson was known very well in Nashville, in that area. Less in the East, probably not until the War of 1812, would Jackson become a figure really known throughout the Southwest.
As you know, I'm concentrating on the duels, and you have on Chapter 11, The Duelist. Who was The Duelist?
This is Charles Dickinson. Dickinson was a bit younger than Andrew Jackson, and Dickinson was reputed to be one of the great shots in the state of Tennessee. And in 1806, Andrew Jackson killed Dickinson in a duel. Some people say that Jackson had engaged in hundreds of duels. That's overstatement. That's not true. Dickinson is the one man that we know that Andrew Jackson did kill in a duel.
How did it happen?
Oh, this is about a horse race. Jackson had a stallion, Truxton, and was going to race a horse owned by Joseph Irwin. Irwin's horse came up lame. Irwin had to pay the default $800. Back then, lots of paper currency, some worth more than others. And when he paid the notes, initially they weren't in the proper currency that they had agreed to. Jackson brought that to Irwin's attention, and Irwin, he did the right thing. So there was no problem there, apparently. Irwin's son-in-law, Charles Dickinson, got involved in this. And he approached Jackson through a friend. Dickinson asked a friend, see what Jackson's problem is with these notes. Jackson said to this man by the name of Swan that there's no problem here, but yes, the initial notes, they weren't what we agreed to. Swan proceeded to go back and say to Irwin and Dickinson that Jackson was complaining, and Jackson had a problem with the notes, and he was saying things publicly about this. Jackson then called Swan a liar. Swan then said that he will challenge Jackson to a duel. Jackson refused to see Swan, to regard Swan as a gentleman, and so he could not duel Swan. Instead, Jackson, who had a colleague with him, went to a tavern where Swan was, and came inside and saw Swan there, and proceeded to cane him, to beat him. This precipitates a duel with Charles Dickinson. Dickinson also had, on at least two occasions, made some comments about Jackson's marriage, not unlike John Sevier. Jackson challenges Dickinson to a duel, uses the aforementioned word poltroon, and they cross state lines into Kentucky, and it's there where Andrew Jackson kills Charles Dickinson.
Talk about the language of the time and compare it to today. Back then, you say that Andrew Jackson wrote about Dickinson, called him worthless, drunken, blackguard, scoundrel. Scoundrel. Yeah. It seems like, as you read your book, that Andrew Jackson had a lot of strong things to say about a lot of things.
Absolutely. Whether he was talking about political enemies, men he was looking to duel, even institutions, how he would sometimes refer, for example, to the Bank of the United States of America or to the Supreme Court. The language could be heavy. Some of it is sincere. I think as he matriculated higher into politics, I think some of it was also a bit theatrical.
When was Jackson first hit by a bullet in all of these duels?
That would have been the Dickinson duel in 1806. Jackson recognized that Dickinson was the superior shot. And so Jackson's strategy was not to fire first. I suppose the overriding hope is that Dickinson, not knowing that Jackson was going to fire first, that Dickinson would fire quickly and perhaps miss his target. However, Jackson did understand that he was going to present himself as a target, and he might in fact be hit, and that's what happened. He was hit in the chest, in the breastbone, probably knocked out a couple of ribs, but he was left standing. Dickinson was incredulous. He couldn't believe it. He thought initially he had missed because Jackson was still standing there. He had to toe the mark. Jackson aimed and Jackson pulled the trigger, but there was a misfire. And so there was some feeling later on that at that point Jackson should have said, well, okay, let's just call off the duel. But Jackson demanded that, in fact, he would get his shot. And so he pulled the hammer back again, and he drilled Dickinson flush in the abdomen. And a few hours later that evening, Dickinson died.
By the way, how long did that particular bullet that Dickinson fired stay in Jackson's body?
That bullet stayed in Jackson for the rest of his life.
Was it? I heard somebody refer to the fact that the bullet itself splintered and that it was treated almost like shrapnel. Was there ever any attempt to get any of that out of his body?
Not really, not that bullet. It was very close to the heart, and surgeons just didn't want to go in there. Jackson, and a second, you can't really call it a duel, but a real fracas. A few years later, he did take a bullet in the arm, and that was later removed during his presidency.
He was 39 when the Dickinson. When he killed Dickinson, what do you remember what he was doing at the time, and did that have any public impact on his image in the state of Tennessee?
He was a public figure. There was the militia position, for example. In some respects, it had a negative impact. There were people who thought that that Jackson was bloodthirsty. There are people who thought that this duel was unnecessary. Charles Dickinson was a lawyer, in some respects, kind of a dandy and kind of arrogant, but had lots of friends. The Supreme Court Justice John Marshall was someone who had tutored him, years earlier. So there were some connections there. And after the duel, a couple of the Tennessee newspapers put out black mourning bunting in print on the pages of the periodicals, paid for by people in Tennessee, Nashvillians, who were mourning the death of Dickinson, and therefore vicariously criticizing Jackson for killing this good man. His reputation did take a bit of a dip.
By the way, you mentioned Supreme Court Justice. How many, and I'm jumping ahead, but I'll come back to more duels. How many justices during his 8 years as president was he able to appoint?
Jackson appointed 6 justices.
How does that compare with other presidents?
Obviously, Washington would have appointed the most because Washington had to appoint the entire first Supreme Court. Interestingly enough, William Howard Taft also appointed, I believe, 6. And unlike Jackson, who had 2 terms, Taft did it in a single term. To have 6 appointments in 8 years is a very high figure that very few presidents could hope to achieve.
Who appointed Taney to the Chief Justice job after John Marshall stepped down?
Jackson did that. Jackson, as we discussed, could be a great hater and could inspire great hate in others. On the other hand, he was very close to, he was very tight, and he was very protective of his friends. Taney had been a loyalist. Taney had, I think, done most of the writing for Jackson's iconic bank veto message. When Jackson was looking to finally kill off the bank and find a secretary of the Treasury who would help him do that, he appointed Taney to that position. And as you mentioned, when Marshall dies, Jackson is going to, again, stand by Taney, move him up in the system, and he becomes the Supreme Court justice.
But Dred Scott, the decision that Chief Justice Taney was responsible for, came some years later. Did he have any decisions while Jackson was president that were controversial?
The decisions that the Taney Court will make are going to be seen as decisions that are going to generally favor the South, generally favor an agrarian states' rights perspective, the plantocracy. And so Jackson, in appointing Taney and doing some other things when he was president, you know, coveting, for example, Texas, where slavery would begin to expand, recognizing the nation state of Texas in the last days of his presidency, that action combined, for example, with the Taney Court, and also combined with other things, you know, for example, having a postal system which would not allow abolitionist literature to circulate in the South in violation, of the First Amendment. These are all things that that historians look at, and they point to the Taney Court and say, it really had Jackson's stamp on it. It had the stamp of somebody who was interested, despite the fact that he very much viewed himself as a nationalist, but someone who did operate from a Southern persuasion.
Go back to the beginning of when you thought you wanted to do Andrew Jackson as a book. How did that process start?
The process started with me beginning to read Jackson's primary source material, his letters, for example. There are two collections, and then also looking at the collections of people who were close to Jackson, family members, politicians, Martin Van Buren's memoirs, for example. And beginning to formulate, kind of a notion, a feel for Jackson, the individual, Jackson, the family man, Jackson, the politician, and of course, not just the life, but the times as well. At that point, I then also began to dip into a lot of the secondary source material, some of which I was familiar with. As I mentioned, as we talked about earlier, I'd done work on Jackson in that period in the Whigs when I was in graduate school. And since graduate school, I teach a course on the topic and stayed up with historiography. So I began to immerse myself in the primary and the secondary literature.
When did you start this?
I started the project in January of 2017.
And how much research time did you spend before you began writing?
Probably about nearly 3 years.
Can you remember, as the process unfolded, when you did, or how you changed your mind about what you thought Andrew Jackson was about?
I think that was early. Reading through Jackson's public papers and reading through Jackson's correspondence, it began to dawn on me that Jackson was not merely this frontier ruffian, but he was also very savvy, very, very canny. He had two brothers. He was the youngest. His mother saw something in him, a mental spark or something. And so it was Andrew Jackson, of all of the Jackson boys, who was predestined, supposedly, to go to the pulpit. His mother wanted him to become a Presbyterian theologian because that would require a certain amount of education, of learning. And she thought that he, more so than his brothers, had that. In these public papers, Jackson could really frame an argument. Jackson could really, really play fast and loose with details. That's not always edifying, but it takes a certain temperament, a certain mind to be able to do that. And so Jackson was much more of a thinking creature than I'd anticipated going into the project.
You say that his closest compeers are Theodore Roosevelt and Richard Nixon. Where do you get that idea?
I think with Nixon, what jumped out at me was that Nixon obviously had an enemies list, whether they were journalists or politicians, the people he thought that were a bit out to get him. With Jackson had that sense of paranoia. Jackson also had his own enemies list. His was mental. He carried it up in his head. But as I mentioned before, he was very effective with it, probably more effective than Nixon. It helped to focus his thinking. The comparison with Theodore Roosevelt is I see in both men this kind of desire to have an aspirational presidency, to do great things, to be significant. Both men had quite the ego. Both men, I think, had a good sense of their popularity, how much they could get away with. Roosevelt, we don't think of Theodore Roosevelt in the same type of contestation that we do Andrew Jackson. But there was a side of Theodore Roosevelt. He could be very diplomatic, but he could also be very pointed, very direct, and a real savvy political manipulator. You can't get that high up in the system without some of those skills. And I think I see a bit of an overlap there, even temperamentally, between the two. Roosevelt, East Coast, but very much interested in portraying himself as someone from the West, a hunter.
You say he might be paired with Douglas MacArthur. Why?
MacArthur was regarded by some as a very cavalier, too off-the-cuff general, someone who had aspirations, maybe beyond the Constitution. I'm not sure that's fair or not, but Franklin Roosevelt thought that was the case, and he thought that, in a famous phrase, that Douglas MacArthur was the most dangerous man in America. These were words that Andrew Jackson had heard when he was president, that Jackson was this military hero that some saw as a chieftain. People worried about his popularity as a military man and whether he could parlay that into political success. But then maybe when he achieved political success, then he would elide the Constitution. He would make himself really above the Supreme Court, above Congress. And in that sense, I think that Franklin Roosevelt saw a little bit of a military chieftain in Douglas MacArthur.
When he was 46, back to the duels, Thomas Hart Benton, this was in 1813. What was he doing then, and how did he have a duel with Thomas Hart Benton?
This is the War of 1812. And Jackson had just returned to Nashville. He had been in Natchez, Mississippi, with an army. On the way back, there was a brigadier inspector, Billy Carroll, who got close with Jackson. He was a young man. Jackson liked his company. This aroused jealousy among some of the young officers, including one Jesse Benton. Jesse Benton challenges Carroll to a duel on some trumped-up issue about lack of respect. Carroll goes to Jackson and asks him to be his second. Jackson says, "Oh, come on, I'm too old for this." He tries to patch things up, but he can't do it. So he incautiously agrees to serve as the second. The duel goes off, and the bottom line is, Jesse Benton gets hit in the bottom. This was not life-threatening, but it was embarrassing. Not long after that, Jackson gets a letter from Jesse Benton's brother, Thomas Hart Benton, who says that Jackson had no business being part of this, that there's a war on, we should not be fighting each other, and that Jackson should have prevailed his opinion as the calm older man. Well, calm, that's a matter of perspective. Benton also said that Jackson had conducted the affair of honor in an unfair manner. And he said that he was not seeking a duel with Jackson, but he would not go through with one if Jackson preferred. Jackson replied back, defending himself and saying that he too was not seeking a duel, but if it's what Benton wanted, he would take up his pistol and do what was right. This is all going to lead to a fracas between the two men. Jackson gets wind that Benton had been publicly saying that Jackson had no business engaging in this duel, that he should have ended the duel, but it had let things go on too long. Jackson declared that since he had been publicly impugned, the next time that he saw Benton, he was going to horsewhip him. He learns that Benton is in Nashville, staying at the City Hotel. Jackson, saying that he must pick up his mail, leaves his home, and it's about 12 miles east of Nashville, and with a friend, goes to Nashville, puts himself up at the Nashville Inn, and collects his mail, and notices that Thomas Hart Benton is conspicuously in the doorway of his own hotel, and walks over, and they begin to fight. Jackson pulls out a gun. He says Dickinson was reaching for his. Who knows at this point? When Jackson pulls out his gun, he's not aware that Jesse Benton was also there, and Jesse Benton fires shots. Jackson is hit in the left shoulder and in the left arm, and Benton is able to make his escape. Both Bentons do. There's a bit of fighting outside, but they're able to leave the scene. Jackson is brought to the inn, and rumor has it that he bled through a couple of mattresses. Doctors were there and recommended that the arm be amputated. Jackson refused that, and as I mentioned earlier, the bullet's going to stay in his arm until 1932. That's during his presidency, when it had moved enough away from the bone, close enough to the skin, that a surgeon felt that he could get it out, and did so.
Just to chat, you said 1932, you meant 1832?
Yes, thank you.
Do I understand this right? Jesse Benton, Thomas Hart Benton's brother, is the one that fired into his arm?
Yes, fired two shots.
So it wasn't Thomas Hart Benton that shot him?
That's right.
And how do you, I mean, in your research, how do you carry all that lead in your body from the first shot from Charles Dickinson to the second shot from Jesse Benton and not have it affect your body?
Well, there are people who argue that it did affect the body, that there might be, several reasons for Jackson's intemperate actions, and perhaps the fact that he was, as you put it, carrying so much lead in his body, perhaps that did have an impact. He was a temperamental man, and we know that he did suffer physically for a number of reasons, but one would be the wounds. He lived into his 70s. He was at that time the oldest president, and these were old wounds by the time that he reached that office.
I want to make sure that our listeners know that the book is a complete biography of Andrew Jackson. We're just concentrating on some of these areas because we only have an hour to talk to David Brown, who is at Elizabethtown College. When you are in the classroom, how often do you teach Andrew Jackson?
Every fall, I teach a course on U.S. history to 1877. And there's always one day that is set aside for the Jacksonian period.
What's the reaction of students when you talk about Jackson?
I think they're bemused. They might know a little bit about Jackson, but to go into some of the detail about the personality, about the duels, for example, I think for them it's just astounding that somebody like that could be president. That this could be for much of our history, a heroic figure.
Has anybody, by the way, ever done a book just on the number of duels he's had and those beyond the ones that you write about?
I don't believe that there's a book simply on Jackson's duels. There is a good book written about 20 years ago Affairs of Honor by a historian, and she looks at dueling culture.
Let's move to when he was 66 and the story about Robert Randolph in 1833 and Richard Lawrence.
Sure. So Jackson, as John Quincy Adams put it, sort of created presidential history by being the first chief executive to have his nose pulled. Randolph had been a purser in the Navy. He had been caught stealing, and Jackson had okayed his dismissal from the service. Jackson was in Frederick, Virginia. There was a ceremony there in regards to Martha Washington. He was sitting there with a couple of handlers, and Randolph approaches, and Jackson thinks that he's going to shake his hand. Randolph is taking off his gloves, and in fact, Randolph reaches over and he grasps Jackson by the nose, and he tweaks it, and apparently it produced bloodshed. That's emblematic in the sense that I think Quincy Adams is right. I think that Jackson's probably the first president to have his nose tweaked. But in a sense, it would be Andrew Jackson, such a combative figure, someone who doesn't back down. Again, someone who made a lot of enemies. The second gentleman that you mentioned tried to assassinate Andrew Jackson. This is on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol. Jackson was attending the funeral of a U.S. congressman, I believe from South Carolina, and the ceremony is over. Jackson is vacating the building. Again, there's quite a crowd there. And this gentleman, he approaches Jackson and pulls out a gun and fires, but it doesn't go off. He then pulls out a second pistol and he fires, but it doesn't go off either. For people who want to see Andrew Jackson as a kind of an otherworldly figure, there's the fact that he survived duels. There's the fact that he, at the Battle of New Orleans, had a tremendous victory over the British, where his side took very few casualties, and the British took many, many casualties. And then to see him, an object of an assassin, the first attempt to assassinate a president, not survive one pistol snap, but two, this seemed to suggest to some people that Andrew Jackson had truly the blessings of God, that Jackson was, in a sense, an immortal figure. This gentleman, he was very quickly subdued. In fact, Jackson had a cane with him and looked like he was eager to bash the man as well, whether to protect himself or just out of some defiance. The man was taken away and eventually declared to be insane and spent, I think, about 25 years or so in an asylum until his death in about the early 1860s.
Near Memorial Day in the Saturday Wall Street Journal, you had a huge review. It took up almost, it was on three different pages, but there's a big graphic of Andrew Jackson. Review written by Richard Norton Smith. What impact did that have on the sale of your book, and what did you think of the review?
I love the review. I thought it was very, very generous. I like the fact that the reviewer told readers about the life of Andrew Jackson, but also the times. I thought it was a very educational review. One could read a review like that and quickly begin to understand both Jackson and his times. As someone who also reads reviews, I'm always grateful when a reviewer in a relative economy of space can do that, can give me an education about an individual or a time period, and I think Richard Norton Smith did that. About the sales, I always have trepidation with sales, so I've not asked my agent or my editor about sales.
Professor Brown, why do you write books?
I suppose because I find the process of research and writing very addictive. It's not what I expected to do. I thought that I'd get my PhD and I would teach. But in 2000, I began to research and write a book on Richard Hofstadter. And since that time, I've never been without, usually, you know, balancing a couple of projects. Obviously, they're in different places. But I enjoy the process of researching. I find writing to be a terrific challenge. Putting down a first draft is you know, just this this great chore, but I really like the subsequent drafts to go back and put words in, take words out, do a bit of painting. I usually go through maybe 12 or 15 drafts.
Who was Richard Hofstadter? Why a book?
Richard Hofstadter, to my mind, was the most consequential American historian of the 20th century. I came to Hofstadter actually through a class on the Jacksonian period. Hofstadter had written a book on the rise of really, you know, popular democracy in America, the rise of the party system. And Hofstadter is a very accessible historian, still read today. And there had not been a full biography of Hofstadter. I think I discovered that, you know, I'd read everything about Hofstadter that I could find. I'd read all of his work, and I think I just woke up one day and I thought, you know, I'm interested enough. I'm going to try to write this man's biography.
Why a book on F. Scott Fitzgerald?
F. Scott Fitzgerald always interested me. I was working on a project on Midwestern historical thinking. And a lot of the research was in Madison, Wisconsin. I spent a few summers there. And one of those summers, I drifted into a used bookstore, and I came across a volume of Fitzgerald's letters. And I was very, very struck with these letters. They were so candid, so raw. And it began to open up things in my own mind about his short stories and his novels. I could see connections there. I think his novel Tender Is the Night is the first novel that really made sense to me, that really kind of affected me. And years later, to run across those letters and to begin to think about Fitzgerald maybe in a more sophisticated way than I had as a student, that prompted me to want to know more about him. So I started to do some of the research, not necessarily thinking I was going to write a book, but that became the product of the labor.
Something happened to Andrew Jackson when he was president that no other president had to deal with, some impeachment, but he was censured. Explain the circumstances and what is a censure compared to impeachment.
Sure. So, you know, Jackson, he's known, among other things, for the bank war. The bank war was prolonged, and his opposition, the Whig Party, was very much opposed to his policy. There was a Whig majority in the Senate, but not in the House of Representatives. If there was a Whig majority in the House, Jackson very well could have been impeached, but there wasn't. So what the Senate did is to show its opposition to Jackson and his actions in regards to the bank, but I think more generally to make the argument that Jackson was exceeding his powers as chief executive, that he really wasn't a Democrat. He was an autocrat. He was censored. Henry Clay from Kentucky, who was a great opponent of Jackson's, he kind of led this crusade. And the argument was that in fact Jackson was acting unconstitutional, that he was taking powers that belonged, whether it was to the courts or to Congress, and he was appropriating them for himself. True to form, when the censure did pass, I think it was 26-20, Jackson responded with a long communication put together by others along with himself. And Jackson defended his record, and then Jackson made the claim that he, more so than the courts, more so than the mere congressman, was really the defender, the representative of the people, because only the president, of course, has to submit himself at that time to a national election. Well, to his opponents, that was the kind of claims that the president was above Congress, that the president was above the courts, that they were so concerned about.
You say in your book that Senator Benton, brother of Jesse Benton, who had put a bullet in his arm, who had nearly killed Jackson in a public brawl 20 years ago, proved to be his old adversary's chief defender. How did that happen?
Jackson got political aspirations, and Jackson realized that he needed to make friends. Jackson was in the Senate on two occasions, one as a young man, and then a second time in the early 1820s with presidential aspirations. He was on a committee. He was heading a committee, chairing a committee, and Benton was part of that committee. Jackson sees Benton in the Senate, and he walks over, and he lets him know when the committee is going to be meeting, asks about his family, and Benton's reply is cordial. And so the two men begin to get along, and Benton will become one of Jackson's great defenders in Congress.
Before we wrap it up, I have a couple of... One is not so minor. The other, and if it was me, I wouldn't be very happy with it. But you referred to something that I've never read before about Jackson, and that is he had a serious tooth problem.
Mm.
Did he lose all his teeth?
I believe he lost all of them. Washington, you might know, had teeth problems as well.
And Adams.
And Adams as well. I think most of them did. So Jackson was not immune from that. We talk about his behavior. We talk about the effect of having these bullets in the body. Also, Jackson had suffered from dysentery. His teeth were gone. This is somebody who had carried on military campaigns throughout the Southwest. As a younger man, had lived in the field, had a very thin frame to begin with. One wonders about his dietary intake on these campaigns in the Creek War, the War of 1812. Jackson's health. He lived a long time, but his health was, I think, always, well, in his adulthood, compromised.
You wrote that he was $26,000 in debt compared to today's money. That's $935,000. Mm. What does that say about him?
What it says is that although Jackson was, I think, rightly critical of the Bank of the United States for its lean towards a speculative economy, that he himself, Jackson, an agrarian, not unlike Thomas Jefferson, an agrarian who also died in debt, that they were in some sense perhaps trapped by their place, by their station. We talked earlier about Jackson wanting to be perceived as a gentleman. Well, gentlemen had certain things. A gentleman had property. A gentleman had a plantation. A gentleman had a fine wardrobe. And these things, they cost money. Jackson was living like a frontier aristocrat, and Jackson was going deeply into debt to fund this.
Last question for you. You say in your book that historians are blinded by Jackson's commitment to the South.
Mm.
What do you mean?
I think for a long time, scholars would take Jackson for his word, that Jackson was a nationalist, his stand against the state of South Carolina in the nullification crisis, ensuring that the federal tariff was going to be paid, the fact that he was an officer in the American military. But if you look at that nullification crisis, the upshot is that while South Carolina would agree that they would, in fact, the state would, in fact, pay the tariff was going to be reduced dramatically over a period of about 9 years. I also think of Indian removal and, the removal of about 60,000 self-governing Native Americans, some of whom did, in fact, own slaves, but most did not. And so by lowering the tariff, which helped industry, free labor, by removing Native Americans, mostly free labor, and bringing in a plantation culture in the Southwest, one can make the argument that Jackson's presidency, in fact, did prove to be a big boon for the South.
I wanted to say to our viewers again, if you're saying to yourself, why in the world didn't he ask about a lot of things, it's because it's a big book. And you can buy it and read the whole thing. And we were just concentrating on a number of things. Jackson has been on C-SPAN so many times that you could probably get a PhD from reading and watching all of it. Where is Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania?
Elizabethtown, it's in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
And how far are you from Philadelphia?
About 90 miles west of Philadelphia.
And have you decided that you're going to write another book? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, I'm working on a book on the Kansas-Nebraska Act and really the issues of 1854 that the country was facing, the kind of collapse of this compromised culture and really the straight road from there to the American Civil War.
Professor David S. Brown, thank you very much for joining us. The book is called The First Populist, The Defiant Life of Andrew Jackson. We appreciate joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We would love to hear from you. You can email us at podcasts@c-span.org.